Today is the 19th of June, 2002. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this evening, we are having Norm Day of the U.S. Forest Service talking about the Holden Mine cleanup operation. Let's listen in.
My name is Christopher Gilia, and I serve the village as operations manager, and it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Norm Day. Norm is the Holden Mine cleanup manager, project manager. But he has a long history with Holden Village. As a student of Rudy Edmonds, he first traveled the village in 1966 at the very beginning of the Porty Museum project. And I'd like to thank Norm in advance for not only tonight's forum, but for the many, many other forums he's presented over the years and his great patience with explaining and in keeping the village informed of the fairly complex progression of the mine cleanup, and also of raising Holden's concerns in the process. So thank you, Norm, for traveling back, and thank you for all your patience with us.
Get out here. I don't mind an opportunity like this any time. It's always a pleasure. The presentation I've been asked to do tonight is kind of a status report on the Holden project, and I know there's some of you, maybe a number of you, that have seen parts of this presentation before, so hopefully you won't be too bored. I have updated it, though, to include the some new information on the feasibility study that we just was delivered to us last week, and on the alternatives that are being considered, and some information about the process we'll use in eventually selecting a remedy, and the estimated cost, which are fairly staggering. You know, but I won't let that out of the box until I get to it. What I'm going to do this evening, and I'm going to try to do it in about an hour, depending on how many questions. I don't mind being interrupted, but that will extend things. And it doesn't bother me until my voice gives out. I'm ready to go, but I know you all have things to do, and so we'll try to get this done in as short a time as period as we can. But we may get into a discussion on the alternatives if you know more about what they're going to look like now. I'm going to give you a little history of the mine and site background, which probably most of you already know anyway if you've been up here before. A summary of the environmental issues or impacts at the site here. A status of the current CERCLA cleanup project and the NERDA activities. And I should mention that my presentations have an ample share of acronyms, and only because it saves space on the slide. If I wrote everything out, we wouldn't have space on each slide. But I'll try to define them as we come to them. And CERCLA stands for the Superfund Act, and it's the Comprehensive Environmental Remediation Compensation Liability Act. So just remember Superfund. And NERDA stands for Natural Resource Damage Assessment. And it's really, it's some requirements that are part of CERCLA, but we generally, when we do a big cleanup project like this, you usually do CERCLA and NERDA. Those two processes are done separately. Here we're combining them together, which is kind of a novel case, and this is the first time it's been done on a big site like this. And then I'll go over a general description of the alternatives that are being considered and kind of give you a real quick review of some of the field activities we did last year here at the site, and then talk about the project schedule. Say I'll answer questions as we're going along, but also save some time at the end for questions. And I'll kind of, can we maybe turn the, or is this bright enough for everybody, or do we need to turn the lights down? This okay? Okay. I'm going to go through the first part of this presentation a little quicker than normal because I think a lot of you have already seen it, and of course you know where you're at here at Holden. I gave this to a group a couple weeks ago, and of course most of them didn't know where Holden Village was. We're well on Lake Chelan, so. Anyway, As you know, the House Isle Mining Company operated the mine for 20 years, from 1937 to 1957. And this is a picture of the mill just shortly after it was constructed in 1937. And of course, Holden Village down here. The mine and mill produced about $66 million of copper and zinc with some gold and silver. That was the value at the time the mine was operational. If you computed the value at today's metal prices, it'd be about $330 million of metals were removed from the mine. During the operation, there's about 57 miles of underground mine workings were constructed in the hill over there. And again, if you've been up to the Mine Museum, maybe some of this is not new to you. This is the 1500 level, or I think you call it the third level around here, but it's the 1500 level of the mine, and it's because it was 1500 feet below the discovery point, which is 15 feet higher up on the hillside, way up almost about tree line. All the ore came out the 1500 level by train and went into the mill and was then crushed and ground and processed, and a concentrate was produced down here and trucked from here down to Lake Chelan, and then from here barged to Chelan, and then put on trucks again and sent to the railroad where it was then sent by rail to Tacoma to the smelter. The ore body is a very steeply dipping, massive sulfide ore body. It has a lot of sulfide minerals in it, which contributes to the problems, environmental problems here I'll talk about later. And the ore body crops out of the surface up here 1,500 feet above the third level. And there are a number of workings into the mine above the 1,500 level for about 1,500 feet. And then the mine continues down about another 1,000 feet or so into the, there are several levels down here. The lower part of the mine is currently flooded, and water comes out the 1500 level portal. If you've been up there, you've seen the stream that comes out there. The ore body is fairly wide. It averages about 80 feet. The rock is very competent or solid, and it allows to use some very bulk mining techniques at this mine. And you'll see some pictures of some very large openings, were called stopes, where they remove a large amount of ore the size of a football field. There are two shafts in the mine. The number one shaft connects the 1500 level with the levels above it. And then the second shaft connects everything from the lower levels of the mine up. Currently we have about 8.5 million tons of tailings on the surface along Railroad Creek in three separate tailings piles. Right here's one. This is Holden Village, right? It's right here. This is the road you come up, and this is Railroad Creek right here. This is tailings pile one, tailings pile two, and three. And of course, the third level where the waste, this is a waste dump, and the mine portal sits right in here. There were, during the life of the mine, they processed about 10 million tons of tailings, or essentially 10 million tons of ore, because really the vast majority of that stayed here as tailings, and 1.5 million tons of tailings were put back into the mine as backfill in the lower levels of the mine. There are, as I mentioned, the two other waste dumps up here, and then we have several waste dumps on up the hillside up here going up to some of the upper levels of the mine. Total acres of disturbance is about 120. Of course, you all know how you get here. And we've been in existence since 1962, and I guess that's part of the big 40-year celebration that's going on. I hadn't thought about it, but it's this year.
Now.
Oh, this is kind of appropriate that I'm here, I guess.
Dancing Saturday night.
The Forest Service and other agencies have done a number of studies up here since the 60s, and they've well identified the impacts from the mine. But it wasn't until the late 80s that the Forest Service was had sufficient funding to do something about it. And in the late 1980s and early 90s, the Forest Service took an interim action out here and used some special funds from the Department of Agriculture to put gravel on the top of the tailings piles and do some recontouring and putting some riprap along the toe of the slopes. And I'll show you some pictures. It solved some of the problems, but it didn't solve the more difficult problems like water quality issues. The interim action, this was before, and you can see this is one of the tailings piles, and originally when the tailings piles were put in, these log cribbings were constructed to help keep the tailings in place. Well, over the years, they rotted, and before we did our work, it was easy for a railroad creek to kind of erode some of the tailings pile, and then in the spring, you had a lot of tailings wash right into railroad creek. So, as part of the interim action, we came in and put large boulders or riprap along the toe of the slope to keep River Creek from eroding. On the surface of the tailings in the spring, when the snow melted, you'd end up with big ponds on the tailings piles, which contributed to the instability of the piles. So we put some drainage channels on the top of the piles to get the water off quickly in the spring. And if you've been here in the summer when the tailings were like they are, you'd often get these big orange dust clouds moving around the village as the winds changed. To solve that problem, we put about 6 inches of gravel over the tops of all the tailings piles and then started these vegetation islands to get vegetation growing again. This is a picture taken 2 or 3 years ago, and you can see that there's a pretty good growth of vegetation starting now on the tailings piles due to our efforts back in the late 80s. Yes?
Could we raise the picture?
Not really. I'm sorry. You can't see over someone's head, or?
You can just see the top.
Yeah, that's... I've got it up as high as it'll go.
There's some seats over here. I said, okay, come on. This is a really good seat here.
Okay. That's the seat of honor.
You want a cushion too?
Got what?
Bro.
No, you're fine. Man.
The color on here is a little off, but anyway, it just shows you what the tailings piles looked like before we put the gravel on them, and this is what it looks like now. Of course, this is the remnants of the mill building. You've probably all seen that if you walk around here. Even though all the work we didn't solve all the problems, so there were still, after we did this work, there were still some potential threats to human health and the environment that existed from the one leaching or movement of contaminants from the mine portal right here is the drainage coming out, and then there are a variety of seeps that come out of the ground at various places here that are directly tied to water moving through contaminated waste rock piles and tailings piles, and they're all contaminated. Contaminants, heavy metals, and some of the water is acidic. And this has a detrimental effect on aquatic and fisheries and railroad creek. There's still cementation or solidification of the creek bed. And what happens, you can see, this is at the base of tailings pile one. I don't know if you've walked down this way, but these orangish water coming out from underneath the tailings are some of the seeps I'm talking about, and they're real high in iron, real iron-rich tailings, because I think I mentioned that this is a high sulfide ore zone that has a lot of pyrite in it, and of course pyrite is iron sulfide, so when the pyrite breaks down with water and air, you produce a kind of a dilute sulfuric acid that helps helps to absorb other heavy metals or metals in the rocks, and iron. There's a tremendous amount of iron in the deposit. So you get these iron seeps here. When the water comes out from under the tailings pile, the pH changes because you're diluting it with water that's more neutral, and you get this iron to precipitate out. And it, you can see it here in the creek bed, and it actually solidifies and almost becomes like concrete. And that really has a negative effect on the critters that the fish eat, the mackerel, vervets, and the fish eat. So there's places up just past the footbridge, as you're walking downstream on the tailing side, there's places where this ferricrete, as we call it, is about a foot thick, and it looks just like orangey concrete, red concrete, right along the creek bed. I don't know if you can see it now at high water. I've never walked along there when the water's been up like it is now. And then you still have very steep, unstable slopes that have the potential for mass failure if the right conditions, like an earthquake happened in the spring when the tailings were saturated. So to kind of give you a quick status of how this project got going, in the early 1997, the Forest Service, EPA, and Washington Department of Ecology began serious negotiations with the company, and we call him the PRP, or Potentially Responsible Party. It's a term that comes out of the Superfund Act, but they're liable. They're the liable party, and they're the company that is the successor in interest to Howe Sound, the company that did the mining. This was the company that acquired Howe Sound's liabilities and assets, and so they're the company that's responsible. Under CERCLA, and then now MOCTA, which is the state of Washington equivalent to the Superfund Act, and it's called the Model Toxics Control Act. So we're doing this cleanup under these two authorities, Superfund and MOCTA. And we began negotiations with the PRP, and in April of 98, we negotiated an AOC, or an administrative order on consent, legal document, directing all parties signed, ourselves and the PRP, directing the PRP, which is now called a company by the name of Incalco, directing them to do a detailed cleanup study here at the Holden Mine. And that study is called an RIFS, to throw out some more acronyms. And this stands for the Remedial Investigation and the Feasibility Study. They're two separate phases of the project. The Forest Service is the lead agency, providing oversight management for the project. EPA and Department of Ecology are cooperating with us. We, Forest Service, as the agency, has also employed an environmental consultant to help us oversee the work that's done by Incalco and their consultant, URS. The remedial investigation phase of the project is really the site characterization, where you take a look at all the impacts at the site and characterize it. And then the feasibility study is the part where you come up with alternatives and then evaluate the alternatives that will clean up the impacts you found in the remedial investigation phase. In addition to this, we're also doing natural resource damage assessment activities in conjunction with the cleanup part of the project. And the Forest Service is the lead natural resource trustee. We have the state of Washington is a trustee. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is a trustee. The Yakima Indian Nation is a trustee. So we have some new players coming into the picture now when we're ramping up the natural resource damage. The goal then is when we, this project, besides currently impacting Rubber Creek, it has damaged or injured natural resources currently and in the past, such as fisheries and the mackerel and vervets. And the natural resource trustees are trying to have those impacts or injuries restored and then be compensated for those losses. And so the idea is that when we make a decision on the remedy, we will also be making a decision on what restoration needs to occur out here and what compensation the trustees will receive from the PRP for damages that can't be restored. Just for information, the Holden Mine project is the largest Superfund project within the Pacific Northwest region, the Forest Service. And back in 1999, I think it was, Forest Service reached a settlement with the PRP for some of our past costs. We had spent a little over $3 million with the interim action we did here in the late 80s, and then we had several years of monitoring work and other costs, attorney's fees, and then interest. So we had a total past cost of about $6.2 million. And we negotiated with the PRP and they paid us $3.1 million, and then agreed to release the Forest Service from any future liability at the site, and then also agreed to do the cleanup remedy when we selected. So we didn't get the full past cost, but we get some other things that were pretty valuable to us as far as those concessions go. Plus, they're paying for the oversight that we're doing. They're paying all of our salary and other costs related to our oversight of their work. In 1997, their consultants, URS, began collecting a substantial amount of environmental data, characterizing the site, and also assessing injuries to the natural resources. A final remedial investigation report was approved by agencies in February of this year, and a draft natural resource injury determination report was prepared by PRP's consultants and delivered to us in February, and we're still reviewing that now. Key findings from the remedial investigation report are that there are seasonal exceedances of water quality criteria in a number of metals, but particularly copper, zinc, cadmium, iron, and sometimes in the year lead at various places along River Creek, and at certain times in the year all the way down to Lake Chelan. And we have a little bit of, well, I'll get to that in a second. There's a reduction in benthic macroinvertebrates and fish populations within the mine area, and it goes down about 3 miles for fish. And then macroinvertebrates, which are the critters the fish eat, there's reduced populations all the way down to Lake Chelan. Of course, the tailings piles are still problems of stability. The maintenance yard and lagoon soils, the maintenance yard, you know where that is, up by the shop. The lagoon is that area off to the right of the road as you're going, just crossing the vehicle bridge. Those soils exceed MACA standards. And then there's some nearshore sediments in Lake Chelan right at the Lucerne Bar, where River Creek empties in and downstream, about a 10-acre area there that is of the bottom of the lake nearshore, not in the deep part, that's contaminated with zinc. Back in 99, the Forest Service and the other agencies hosted an acid mine drainage workshop here that brought people from all over the U.S. and Canada, experts in acid mine drainage and how to remediate it here, to look at the site and discuss issues. Very productive. Well, we're currently in the feasibility phase of the project. We completed the remedial investigation phase back in February. It was completed, and now we're into the feasibility study, which will, that document will provide a detailed evaluation of the alternatives for cleaning up the site and then some of the restoration options. We received the draft feasibility study last week. Holden Village has received a copy, and it's here somewhere. So if you're not satisfied with the answers I give you, or you want a lot more information, you can spend some time with it. There are 8 alternatives that were analyzed in the feasibility study, 7 action and 1 no action. And I'm going to talk more about these later, but I just wanted to kind of tell you where we are in the project. Back in 2000, we, as a part of the feasibility study, we felt it was important to enter the mine and gather some information about the underground workings, about how water moves through the mine and the quality of that water, thinking that we might be able to devise some methods by which we can treat the water inside the mine or divert clean water from dirty water and cut the cost of treating water once it comes out of the mine. So we entered, not we, but the consultant, the mining contractor for the company, entered the mine in 2000. It had to repair the collapsed 1500 level portal, of course, has been collapsed, many of you know if you've been up here before, and plugged with water backed up behind it. After that was dewatered, we then tore out the old mine portal. And here's a view inside the mine, and we crawled back in there. We had to put our pumps in to dewater the mine. This was beyond the area that was collapsed into the solid rock. And before we dewatered it, you can see that it's like rings in a bathtub. At certain times of the year, this whole mine portal was filled with water all the way up to the top here. But we pumped about 3 feet of water down before we started removing the collapsed features. We didn't want to have a mass or a sudden release of water if we had broken into that when it was still backed up. Here we are with the water discharging out of the mine. And then it ran down into the lagoon area where the particulates were settled out. This is why the mine portal was collapsed. In that first 100 feet, you go through the glacial till, and the mine timbers, you see the uprights here, these are the timbers across the back. They're broken, they rotted and collapsed. You can see a big glacial boulder sitting in there. And this was like this the whole 100 feet. It all had to be torn out. They replaced it with steel supports and timbers. And this is the crew working inside. And as they were working, they had to drag some of the huge boulders out with their backhoe. They couldn't put it in a bucket. It was so heavy, they had to drag it out. Once we got that portal completely repaired and got up to where the bedrock started, this was what we had in front of us. This picture made the front page of Wenatchee World, by the way. we had a mixture of what I call slime, but it's an iron and aluminum precipitate that, just like what you have the ferrocrete forming in the river, this was forming inside the mine. As the pH of the water changed, the stuff precipitated out, and it's real gooey stuff. And you had all these timbers in here that we later found out be railroad ties. When the mine closed down, they salvaged the rail, left the railroad ties, and when the water came up, all the railroad ties floated down in big piles of them with all this precipitate around it. These guys, we didn't know how much of this we had, so the miners thought they would walk back and see how far this stuff went. And they got back about 70 feet and came back because it was too dangerous to go any further. But this guy is about a little over 6 foot tall, and it looks like he's standing on the floor of the mine, but he's not. This stuff is amazing. He was suspended above the floor in this precipitate, and the guy above him over here is walking on some of these mine timbers, and tremendously hazardous conditions to try to, you could have easily slipped and fallen. Anyway, they came out. And they called in the big guns. We brought in a big piece of mining equipment called an LHD to get in there and tear all those timbers and slime out of there, the precipitate. The timbers are stockpiled up there on the third level if you've been up there. They're in pretty good shape. I don't know what Village is going to do with them, but if you pressure wash the outside and get all that orange off of them, I think you can probably use them for landscaping or something. As long as you're sure there's no copper or zinc in them. Anyway, we got back into the mine and we did several rounds of sampling where we were sampling the water. We've gotten into the mine at the 300 level, the 1100 level, and the 1500 level now for various reasons. But we've only explored a very small portion of the mine because there are some real hazards in the mine that prevent us going much further, and probably never will, really, when it comes right down to it. But it is pretty unsafe. We have put locking gates and in all the openings so people can't wander into the mine anymore. And we've discovered that there have been a number of people in the mine over the years, and it's just a wonder that someone hadn't been seriously injured.
Is there water above the 1,500 foot level?
Well, there's water coming in from above the 1,500 level. There is, but it drains through the mine. There, in the spring, early summer, there's quite a bit of water backed up behind a small cave on the 1,100 level. So there's water on the 1,100 level at some times in the year. But it's just right at the portal. Inside the mine, we also found some what I call scum, but it's just it looks like soap suds, but it's bacterial growth. There's certain types of bacteria that really like acid mine drainage, and they just really feed on it. And it's actually a remediation process that will be used here probably as part of their cleanup remedy, is to use natural processes to help precipitate out some of the metals. This is way back in the mine at the number two shaft. Here the consultants are running some instruments down the number two shaft, which is totally flooded, to get some sampling data about the water, some temperature data about the water at depth in the number two shaft. And then at the end of November, late November, we finished things, and this is kind of what we had the mining contractor restore the portal to make it look something like it did before we tore it down. And so this is what it looks like in the winter up there. It looks just about the same now, except no snow. Okay, these are the eight alternatives. And for several of the alternatives, there are sub-alternatives. So in a way, we really have a lot more than eight alternatives. The first one is the no action. And I'm going to go over each of these in a little more detail, but this kind of gives you the range of alternatives. And really, as you go down, the alternatives not only become more expensive, but they do a lot more disturbance and costs associated with them. And just to kind of let you know how we evaluate these alternatives, according to the National Contingency Plan, which are the regulations that implement Superfund, there are seven criteria that we use in analyzing in detail the alternatives. And you can read these here, but the first two, overall protection of human health and the environment, and compliance with applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, essentially laws and regulations, or ARARs, these two are mandatory, are called threshold criteria. So before you go any further, before you can select an alternative, you have to meet these two for sure. And then the alternatives are evaluated against each other as to how well they do long-term effectiveness and permanence, how well they reduce toxicity, mobility, and volume through treatment and volume of the hazardous materials. Short-term effectiveness is generally during the time that it's considered during the time that the remedy is during the construction period. Short, and then implementability, how easy or difficult it is to implement the remedy, and then the cost. So cost is a factor in the evaluation of these alternatives. Then we have, there's some additional criteria, and that's the state acceptance and community acceptance. And these are after we've gone through the evaluation of the seven criteria, these then are the alternatives are evaluated based on comments received during the public comment period on the proposed plan. And I'll talk more about that later. The proposed plan is the proposed remedy that the agencies have selected. That goes out for a public, 90-day public review period. And then in addition to these two, there's a 10th criteria that was negotiated when we negotiated the administrative order on consent, And that's how well or to what extent each remedy achieves natural resource restoration goals, and then the potential for doing both remediation and restoration. So in our case, we're using 10 criteria. Then once we get through that part of it, then any alternative that we select based on the earlier evaluation has to meet these remedial action objectives. And obviously protect human health and the environment within a reasonable time frame for a number of things. Groundwater, surface water, soil, and sediment all have to meet the remedy would have to meet those objectives. Also, another objective is the perform the natural resource damage restoration. And then another one that should be important to hold them is the remedial action will be implemented in a manner that protects human health and environment, including Holden Village residential community during and after construction. And I think, I don't know if you've had the chance, was that, I know you and Christopher probably looked at it a little bit, but they've done a number of things to try to meet that particular objective to not impact Holden Village during the construction. Okay, so let's look at the various alternatives. I'm getting a pair of stands. I'm going to sit down. This is the no-action alternative, and basically what it will amount to is implementing institutional controls and physical access restrictions. Institutional controls would be like deed restrictions or permits or... there'd be probably be a covenant that we would, since the Holden Village is the PRP, there'd be a covenant that, for you not to, that would be attached to your deed saying that you would not mine the deposit or some other things like that. The Forest Service has withdrawn this area from mineral entry so that there will be no future mining activity here that could possibly impact the remedy once it's constructed. Physical asset access restrictions. These little symbols here indicate the current mine openings that are open. We have either a locking gate like we have on the 1500 level main portal. We have locking bat gates on the other portals that are open, and so they prevent access into those parts of the mine. And then we have a fence around the mill building to keep people from entering that. It's kind of a safety area, a safety reason, but just the same, it's still preventing access into those areas. There would be environmental and slope stability monitoring. In other words, there would be a fairly aggressive monitoring of the slope stability here and of water quality in the River Creek just to see if things get worse or better. We're not doing anything other than monitoring, but there'd be some limited mine actions that would call for going back into the 1500 level mine and removing the remainder of the mine the mine timbers and precipitates that are in there in the first couple thousand feet of the mine, get that out of there so that we don't have the potential for a mass release of precipitates. And then we would depend upon the mine or the revegetation of the tailings piles to continue naturally. And that remedy, the estimated cost is $2 million to do that, which is basically, well, very little. The next alternatives from 2 to 3 have a number of common features to all of them, and so instead of repeating them for each alternative, I'll just kind of list them here. Besides, although each of those alternatives will have institutional controls and physical access restrictions, these first three are just kind of building on what you already have in the no action alternative. Then under the mill building actions, that would include removing contaminated soils and materials from the mill building area. The soils are contaminated. You have still have concentrate inside the mill building. So those would be removed. In the process of removing those materials, we probably would need to remove most of the steel superstructure that's left at the mill for safety reasons. And I kind of suspect that when we get done, the whole mill area would look like the lower part of the mill that's been pretty well cleaned up. And what soils are contaminated would be removed or covered. In the maintenance yard actions, that of course includes around the shop and in your parking area and all that area and through there where the soils are contaminated. The planned action would be to cap that area. In other words, your driveway and parking area would be capped with a foot to 18 inches of concrete or asphalt, so you'd have a nice parking area up there. Would be get done. That's to prevent infiltration of water into the contaminated soils and prevent that from leaching and moving further down the slope. So that's the reason for the capping. The lagoon area, the soils, contaminated soils would be removed and relocated to one of the waste dumps, one of the tailings piles. The former surface water retention area, that's over by the ventilator portal, that would be capped with soil. Copper Creek diversion culvert, this is down where the water comes out of the hydro plant. That's coming from a Copper Creek diversion, so it's being diverted from Copper Creek and runs through the hydro plant, and then that would be put in a culvert as it comes out of the hydro plant until it goes back into Railroad Creek. It would be either a steel or a concrete culvert that would be placed in. Let's see, and then Copper Creek, and then Railroad Creek rehabilitation. Portions of Railroad Creek where the Fair Creek is would be removed. Fair Creek would be removed, and Railroad Creek would be restored. There'd be some enhancements for fisheries. So all these are common to the alternatives 2 through 8. Here's kind of a schematic of what alternative 2 would look like. In addition to the things we do in our institutional controls, this is a water management alternative, and each of these alternatives becomes more aggressive as we go through 8. Here, we're going to remediate the site by just managing the water, not treating it, but managing it. And what we would do in this case is there would be diversion of upgradient surface and near surface water around the mine site, and they would put a cutoff trench completely around the mine site. This is, of course, the main portal right here, so this would be above the main portal. This isn't shown exactly right here, but this trench would go around and cut off all the water and divert it into Railroad Creek or into Copper Creek right there. Then we'd have another diversion around the tailings piles, again, where we'd be diverting water that's moving down slope from coming in contact with contaminated materials. There'd be some additional recontouring of the surface of the tailings pile to facilitate better movement of snow melt off. Let's see. Okay, we would then also tailings pile slope actions. The toe of the slope here would be cut back to make it more stable on the various tailings piles. Riprap would be placed, additional riprap would be placed along the tailings piles. This is the mill area, maintenance area here where you're going to have some of the actions take place. This is the lagoon area that I mentioned before. And then under these alternatives you would have, this is the 1500 level main, 1500 level ventilator, and you would have hydrostatic bulkheads put in there to prevent water from coming out. Each of the other portals, some of which are currently caved, they would all be airtight bulkheads would be installed in all those to prevent air from moving into the mine. And then there would be a hydrostatic bulkhead put in at the 1100 level. And this is just all managing the water, not treating it. And this, there are two sub-alternatives here, A and B, and their cost ranges from $18.8 to $20 million. We haven't even treated the water yet, and that's the cost. Now we have, when you look at the remainder of the alternatives, 3 through 8 involve some kind of water treatment. And so what the water treatment amounts to is a collection, down gradient collection of west area water, and that will be the area of the mine. The discharge, prior to discharge to River Creek, the portal drainage, the shallow drain water, all was coming from Honeymoon Heights area, the mill building, the waste rock piles, would all be collected and then treated. And the treatment includes a chemical addition of lime, quick lime to raise the pH. Then it would be conveyed to an unlined series of treatment ponds where precipitation clarification would take place. And then aerobic wetlands polishing. And this is where the aerobic condition where you have bacterial growth in there that'll help precipitate the metals. And as this process works, the idea is to get the metals to precipitate out of the water. And it's estimated that approximately 800 or 1,200 tons of sludge would be generated every year from these wetlands treatment or ponds. The treatment of water in the east area would be the same, would involve the treatment, the same type of treatment for the west water. Okay, alternative 3, you've got the same water management things you had in the earlier alternative, plus now you have west area treatment. So you're treating the water, contaminated water, on the west side of the mine, which is all this area here that drains the mine, the mill, but not the tailings pond. So you would have a water treatment, these treatment ponds be located in this general area. First, this is the old lagoon area, and then going out toward, this is the Copper Creek diversion right here. These green lines are where we're collecting the water, the seeps and that. They're coming down slope from the mine area and from the tailings or from the waste dumps in the mill area. This square right here is a building that would be used to where the lime is added to the water before it goes into the ponds.
How much lime are you talking about bringing up here?
You know, it says in the draft FS, and I forgot. I mean, I don't remember. I read it, but I don't remember right now. A fair amount. I mean, I could look that up. Well, no, I don't have it here, but someone can look it up. Under alternative 4, again, we have everything we had in the previous alternatives, plus now we're treating... not treating the water in the west part of the mine, where we're treating the water on the west part of the mine that comes from the tailings piles. And here we're collecting all the seeps that come out along these tailings piles and running them through, in this case, two separate areas where we have these ponds, wetland environment, where we do the same kind of physical and chemical treatment of the water. Right here we would have to relocate Railroad Creek around this bend to make room for this wetlands area in here. One of the alternatives, alternative C, or sub-alternative C, involves a substantial relocation of Railroad Creek. Instead of just here, it would relocate it from here all the way down past this big wetland area down here, past the end of Tailings Pond 3, and move it closer to the road over here. And this was the one idea that shot down the idea of the drainage field being located below the road down there. Anyway, these alternatives range from 29 million to 62 million. Okay, alternative five, and again, there's three sub alternatives here. It's very similar to the previous ones, except that here we're doing water management and treating water from both the east and west portions of the mine. So you have a treatment series of ponds here, here, and here. And then in addition to everything else we're doing, we also relocate Rubber Creek here, and then under sub-alternative C, we relocate it the whole length of the tailings ponds. These series of alternatives range from $34 to $65 million. Alternative six involves water management and treatment of the water like we've done in alternative five, but also in this case capping the tailings piles and the waste dumps with an impervious membrane of some kind, either clay or probably some kind of fabric that's impervious, like you use for your, if you maybe put in any of these ponds and that. So, of course, that would, while it would prevent water from infiltrating into the tailings piles, it would also prevent continued revegetation of the tops of the tailings pile. So while it may solve some problems, it would create some other things that maybe wouldn't be too acceptable, because we wouldn't be able to reclaim that area and make it look like the other area. But these other actions are the same. The big addition is the capping. Here we go from 70 to 60 to 76, almost $77 million cost. Alternative seven, again, we're getting more and more aggressive. In this case, we are going with capping, but also consolidation in addition to water management and treatment. Here we are going to relocate tailings pile one, tailings pile three, and the two big waste dumps into one big consolidated pile in the area of tailings pile two. So we would have to increase the height of that tailings pile, or that big consolidated pile, plus go higher up on the hillside. We would still have the same water management trenches. In this case, we would then treat water from the west side of the mine and then treat the water that comes out from this big pond. Because we're doing so much reconstruction or relocation of the tailings piles and waste dumps, you're looking at $103 to $110 million. And then the granddaddy of them all is alternative eight, which is similar to seven in that you're dealing with a consolidated pile here, and the same, everything else is the same. But in addition to the consolidated pile, you're putting a containment barrier or slurry wall completely around this big consolidated pile. That would be like a concrete slurry wall all the way down to probably bedrock, or at least down to where the tailing, or where the glacial till, where you intersect the glacial till, there's not movement of water through the glacial till. Then you would install, once you got this completely contained, like a bathtub, you would then put a series of wells on the top of this pile, pump the water continuously, and then this line just shows you would be pumping along that line and then running all that water that you pump out of here through a big treatment plant down here that would consist of the lime addition and the wetlands system. And that's the darn near $120 million alternative. So before I get off of the subject of the alternatives, do you have any questions on the alternatives while we're still up? Yes.
If I understood right, you talked of plugging the current openings.
Yes.
Would that tend to raise the water level in the shafts and increase the hydrostatic pressure that
yes.
could leak out in some crack somewhere?
It could. That's a concern we have. There are so many little variances to these alternatives and details that it's hard to get into in a short presentation like this. So I've glossed over a lot of things, hoping that maybe some things would come out in questions. But that is a concern we have. The idea behind putting hydrostatic bulkheads in the 1500 level main and 1500 level ventilator portal is that if we use any of the alternatives where we're treating water, the treatment system works best if you have a constant flow of water through the treatment plant. So one way of doing that is because the water, if you've been here later in the year, as the snowmelt begins, you have a pretty high flow of water out of the mine, and as you get toward fall and winter, that flow diminishes substantially. So if you back up the water in the mine, and then have a release so that you can measure and have a certain measured constant flow out of the mine, that would help in the treatment process. Well, there are two ways to do that. One is to put bulkheads in and allow the water to rise in the mine, maybe 100 to 200 feet. So that would increase the hydrostatic head behind those bulkheads. And while it can be safely engineered to withstand those pressures, there's always, you know, the chance of a failure of the bulkheads. The other option that we have the company considering is instead of raising the water up, is to draw down the water in below the 1500 level and then allow it to raise during the wet season and draw it down again. And you'd still maintain a constant flow of water to the plant. You wouldn't have the hydrostatic bulkheads. I saw a hand somewhere, yes.
The active treatment alternatives sound like there's some ongoing cost and some personnel that would be on site fairly permanently. Could you give us a sense about size of the personnel who might be on site permanently and the ongoing cost? I assume these prices don't include that annual cost.
Yes, these prices would include the operation and maintenance cost. And I don't know what they are for each alternative without digging things out and looking at them. But all of the alternatives that involve treatment use a passive water treatment process where you add a little bit of lime to get the pH up, which will help precipitate metals out, but then use the wetlands and the aerobic condition to complete the process of removing metals. So it's really not an active treatment system, but considered passive. The agencies are not convinced that a passive treatment system will remove sufficient amount of the metals to get to water quality standards. And so we've asked them to evaluate the need to put in an active treatment plan. And this is evaluated in the FS, and they have concluded that the passive treatment system will work and get to standard. We have just gotten the documents, so we haven't had a chance to verify what they're saying in the FS, and so we haven't bought into that yet. But if we went with an active system, you would have to have a fairly large, a larger building than you would use for just adding lime to treat the water. You'd have to have power, more power than is currently available to run that type of plan, and you probably need at least one person on site all the time this plant running, and just to be sure that it keeps running properly. And maybe more than one person, I'm saying at least one person all the time. And then there will be other things that will be going, other parts of the remedy will continually have to be checked, and maintenance will have to be done on all these collection systems. And so you're talking about maybe another one or two people that maybe one anyway that need to be around, and the costs associated with that to do the routine maintenance of all these facilities. And if you get into this alternative here with pumping and treating, you're talking a fairly good sized workforce that needs to be here, I think, just to keep things going. You know, at least maybe three people. And I haven't read that far into the FS, so if I, you know, I could be wrong about that. I haven't had the time to get that far into it. If you deal with the passive system, you know, you wouldn't need quite as many people. And since this is going to be, this treatment system will be forever, what we do in these situations is that the company will set up a trust fund, and this will continually, the interest off of that will continually pay for operation and maintenance and monitoring of this indefinitely. And I saw a comment over here.
Regard to that passive treatment system, relatively speaking, the ponds look small,
right,
to me compared to the other areas. Tailings pond. Would a pilot study, a pilot plant, be set up to run a test on it to see whether, you know, how much lime you need to add and whether or not the pond is big enough to take the amount or the volume of water on a daily or a weekly or a monthly basis?
We've thought about doing that. We've talked about doing a pilot study. Of course, that just delays everything a while, but there are a number of other mine sites that have acid mine drainage problems where this type of process is being used, and it's working in some cases. In other cases, it's not working as well as you'd like. They have water samples, and they've done a number of bench scale tests in labs, so that they're confident anyway that this process will work with the volume of water that's coming to the mine. And based on the chemical analysis they've done and calculations, they believe it's going to work now.
Well, it seems to me space is so critical.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be a shame to spend $20 to $60 million and find out you need twice the space.
Right.
And it isn't there.
You know, they calculated the size of the ponds and the retention time in the ponds, the water will take for it exits the wetlands, you know, in their calculations, they've designed and sized the ponds to get that job done. If the agencies buy into a passive water treatment system, we're going to want to have a big hook in there saying that if the monitoring shows that they're not meeting water quality standards, that they're going to have to then go to an active treatment system. If they went with an active treatment system first, then it would probably be that, you know, those are pretty well known to work, and we wouldn't have to have a big hook for them to come back in and do more work. So, as I say, it's really too early. We haven't really had a chance to study all of the analyses that are in the document about how this treatment system is going to work.
The size of the treatment areas are based on the water flow, not on the size.
The volume of water coming through and the chemical content of the water.
Not the size of the tailings.
Right. No, it's based on the volume of water and how much metals in the water and how much time it will take, retention time in these ponds, to precipitate enough to put out. Some other factors that are really going to be complicating, and I'm assuming they consider them, is the fact you get around, 300 and some inches of snowfall here over the winter, and how that's going to impact these wetlands. And I had a question up above.
Yeah, I was just wondering how much of the estimated cost, $120 million in this case, would be paid for by the DALCO?
All of it.
All of it. Nothing from the super fund?
No. We're not tapping into the super fund, because this is not on, well, it's a little bit on private land, but this site, while we're doing the cleanup under the Superfund law, it's not a Superfund site. In other words, it's not on the national priorities list. I see all kinds of questions. I hope I get you in the right order.
I don't know anything about Intelco, but are they facing the same kind of liability elsewhere, and how deep are their pockets?
Their pockets are fairly deep, and they are facing multiple mine sites around the country. Another big one that they're working on is on the National Forest also, and it's down in Idaho, called the Blackbird Mine. Okay, you
comment about the heavy metals and so on, but what about the arsenic and cyanide?
There's no cyanide that's been detected in the sampling. There's a little arsenic, not much, and a little lead, but not much. It's not. Most of the pyrites around here didn't have. They were not acetopyrites that had a lot of arsenic, so there was fairly little arsenic in the deposit to begin with. Way in the back, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see faces.
I know,
so.
Diane, over
oh.
here. This seems to me it's the first time that I've heard the word restoration being applied. I know that remediation, and my understanding is that there's a pretty big difference between those.
Well, we've...
Is this... Is it... Have I just not been understanding, or is this a kind of new element?
No, it's not new. We were talking restoration right when we first negotiated the agreement with the company that they would do their remediation and also do the natural resource restoration. The natural resource damage part of this project involves restoration to the extent they can restore and then compensating for those resource injuries they can restore. And the idea is trying to bring them both together so that we can incorporate as much restoration into the remedy that's selected as possible. Restoration of the natural resources. And most of these big mine cleanup projects will involve one or the other first, go completely through the cleanup or go completely through the natural resource damage phase before they do the next. And we're trying to save time and cost by doing them together. Here again. For what purpose? Well, you could, but then you'd have a big dam, and you'd end up with precipitates behind that dam, and the fish wouldn't be able to go up and down River Creek then. In this case, the precipitates, the sludge that's going to be produced every year, this 1,200 tons of precipitate, there'll be a disposal site somewhere probably up in this area for that to be disposed of. Did I see a hand back?
How is the contamination within the mine shaft compared to that of the tailings? We've always understood the tailings were the big problem.
Well, it's kind of interesting that there's the chemistry is different on the water coming out of the mine as opposed to the water coming out of the tailings. The water coming out of the mine is only slightly acidic and has primarily the heavy metals, copper, cadmium, and zinc.
The natural.
It's what's left in the ore body because that's what was in the ore body. And some iron, but not as much as you have in the tailings. The water or the seeps coming out from underneath the tailings are fairly acidic in the 3 pH range as compared to around 5 to 5.5 coming out of mine. They're acidic. They don't carry the same amount of lead, of copper, lead, zinc, and cadmium, but they carry a tremendous amount of iron. And that's why you get all the Fair Creek formed underneath the tailings. So each treatment system has to be kind of somewhat geared to the specific metals you're trying to precipitate out.
Yeah. What's the timetable for all of this?
I'll get to that in a few more slides.
Any of these things being applied to future mines, like this big one in the Okanagan Forest they're talking about, to keep them from becoming sites like this 20 or 30 years?
There are some differences there. They wouldn't be dealing with tailings, and it's an open pit, although now maybe an underground mine. Acid mine drainage is a concern, and there are things you can do before you begin mining to mitigate acid mine drainage.
They're not processing and concentrating the ore there too.
Well, they're not using a flotation process like was used here. They're doing a vat leach, where they would leach using cyanide remove the gold and silver from
from the ore in a vat leach situation. So there's some differences in the way it's being treated. And then if you design things up front, there are things you can do to reduce or to keep the mine from producing acid drainage, which then really causes some problems. Okay, I've got a few more slides, and then we can open up for any additional questions. Just to kind of go over some of the stuff we did last summer. Last year, we went back into the mine and did some more sampling of the water inside the mine. And then we've been having quite a debate for the last couple of years on whether there are bats in the mine. There may be some baddie people that go into the mine, but we're not sure yet if there are bats in the mine. And the reason we're concerned, some of our biologists with Forest Service that have been in the mine, I believe it has a tremendous potential to be a hibernaculum for bats, which is where bats would hibernate over the winter. There are a lot of bats, including some of the threatened endangered bats, in even here in Holden Village in the summer and other places further up in the Okanagan, that include the Thompson big-eared bat that no one knows where they go in the winter. And the mine has a fairly constant temperature year-round, around the low 40s to mid-40s. It has good airflow through the mine. And you have these fast underground workings and stoke for the bats could be undisturbed for the winter. And we've determined that there's no use of the mine during the summer by the bats because it's too cold for them. But there is a real habitat and a potential use as a hibernaculum. And if the mine is serving as a significant hibernaculum for bats, then we may, instead of having airtight bulkheads put in to the mine to restrict air into the mine and bats, we would have bat gates put in. And, restricting air to the mine, one of the objectives of that is that would diminish or slow down the formation of acid mine drainage. So the company doesn't want to deal with bats. They would rather put an airtight bulkhead in and have it once and over with. However, we're trying to find out what the case is. Right now, we do not have any direct evidence yet that the bats are using the mine for hibernaculum. So last fall, we put in some remote monitoring instruments to help us determine what's going on. And this right here is called a Trailmaster, and it's an infrared detector that counts anytime something crosses the infrared beam. And so we've got several of these inside the mine near the portal, and then in other places in the mine, on the 300 level, the 1100 level, and the 1500 level. And these are set up, and they're continuously recording. The batteries will last over a year, and they're continuously recording. And we'll go in every once in a while and download. We have a little instrument. We just connect it with a cord, and it downloads all the data that's been collected. And it will know if things have been going across this infrared sensor. In some cases, it's going to be bats. In other cases, it could be critters that are, like pack rats and stuff like that. But we should be able to make a pretty good guess as to what it is based on the time of year. Bats would be coming into the mine to hibernate, in October, November time frame, and then they come out and probably in April or May, and we can't get into these workings all the time to observe them, so that's why the remote equipment. This gadget right here is called a hobo, and it continuously records temperature and humidity in the mine. So we'll have, we've got a number of these scattered around the inside of the mine, so we'll know what happens year-round as far as temperature and humidity. Here's one of the consultants installing one of these hobos inside the mine. This is on the 1500 level, And you notice how black it is behind her? You're looking into one of these huge stopes. It's so far back that the light, you can't see the other side of the stope. And of course she missed this path. This stope is on the 1500 level, and it's hard to see in this picture, but the floor of this stope is actually tailings. This is one of the stopes that they backfilled with tailings all the way up to the 1500 level. This stope then goes several hundred feet higher. And this is a picture of what it looked like during the mining days. See the man standing right down here, the miner? So it goes several hundred feet up, just a huge cave where they mine all the ore out. It's 80 feet across and hundreds of feet high. And see these puddles of water right here is, when they pump the tailings in, they pump them in fluid, and the water is sitting on top of the tailings. So it probably went down several hundred feet more before. And so the bats could be just having a ball in there in the wintertime. We wouldn't know it. Some other work that was done last fall. This was a collapse feature that's up above the portal on the 1500 level that was repaired. They stuck those nice styrofoam blocks you've seen up there. I don't know how many they put down in that hole, but there's a bunch of them in there, and then they covered up with sticks. And I don't know if you guys have all figured out what you're doing those yet or not.
What was the point of putting the styrofoam in there?
Well, one, to keep people from going into this opening and preventing it from collapsing. The engineers thought that if the roof of this collapse feature were to cave more, this is right above that newly constructed portal on the 1500 level, they felt that if that were to collapse, it might cause the newly constructed portal to collapse, and we'd be right back and having to do it over again.
So is that a horizontal hole or a vertical?
It's horizontal, and it kind of goes down too, so it's actually both.
So the styrofoam in there to prevent it from...
Yeah, it's light, and it'll keep it from collapsing, yet and keep people out. It just doesn't look pretty good. And there's a lot of excess stuff. I thought you were going to have a contest of what to do with that stuff. We also, late last fall, we installed several monitoring wells down gradient of tailings pile 3 to use for monitoring the quality of the water. There's one across Railroad Creek, and there's several on this side of Railroad Creek. We can continuously monitor water and get water quality. They came up and did some borings on the top of the tailings pile for geochemical and geotechnical studies that were being used to produce the draft feasibility study. Fun time to be out drilling. And then they went back to Lake Chelan and collected some more sediment samples from the bottom of Lake Chelan, nearshore sediment samples to do some bioassay work on for zinc. This is the schedule. We're right here. The draft feasibility study has been submitted last week. We're hoping to have the final feasibility study by fall, looking at the amount of time it'll take us to review the document and then to get another document back, the final back. We're probably looking at late October, early November for a final feasibility study. If we can keep to the schedule, review schedule, that's what we're looking at. We're hoping if we get to this point, we have a real close document that will be ready to go out with a proposed plan. And once the final FS has been prepared, Intalco, their consultant, kind of drops out of the picture from the standpoint they don't do any more at this point in time. The agencies then will take the RI and the feasibility study and select the remedy that we feel best meets the objectives of the site. And it may be one of the remedies that's actually considered in the FS, or it may be a combination of alternatives, or it may be something entirely different. And we send that out as a proposed plan to the public for a 90-day formal comment period, in which we'll be having public meetings and things like that and collecting comments. And then we'll, from that and from the comments, we will then produce a record of decision sometime probably, I doubt if it will be yet this year, but it's probably going to be sometime in the winter, January, February, March time period. Hopefully we'll have a record decision. We're fairly confident that at times we may be at odds with the PRP and their consultant, but generally, compared to a lot of other sites, we really are on pretty good terms, and we've been able to work through most of our difficulties. So we're hoping that even though we don't have a record of decision yet, we're going to start negotiating the consent decree, which is a legal binding document that will direct the company to do the cleanup and pay for it, and to also do the natural resource damage restoration and compensation. We're hoping we can begin those discussions once the final plan goes out, but before we have a record of decision. If we have a record of decision sometime, in the March, February, March period, we then go into remedial design, which is when the company will take that final remedy and do a detailed engineering design for the remedy. And that will involve additional work next summer, assuming we keep to the schedule, of mine entry work and maybe some additional sampling and drilling and other things out here. So there will be likely some kind of early actions related to the remedial design next year. Then full-blown construction of the remedy should begin in the spring of 2004. And depending on what remedy is selected, will last 2 to 3 years, 2 to 3 construction seasons. And just to let you know what the facilities are like underground. No place for I haven't seen one that says women yet underground, but we've been able to have that use both sections when we've been underground. So just kind of winter shot looking down over the site. And we have a web page. This is the forest, the Wenatchee Forest webpage, and you can, the website, we do have a webpage on the home cleanup project. We've got a bunch of pictures you can download on from inside the mine, and we try to keep the information somewhat up to date, but it's usually running a few months behind.
I think that's like from the home website.
Yeah, I think it is, too, from the home.
How will this remediation process affect the program at Holden?
Well, it will, the objective is to minimize that impact. But during the full blown construction phase, there's going to be a lot of heavy equipment on that side of Gravel Creek, and the company is planning on putting a bridge across Lower Creek below Tailings Pile 3 for all the access of heavy equipment, so they wouldn't be going through the village. But when we start doing that construction, it's going to have some significant impacts on your use of the Holden Village's use of all of your facilities over there. I know that when they do the remedial design work, they will try to do the construction in a manner that would reduce those impacts or minimize those impacts, but there's still going to be some interruption of services. Obviously, when we construct those big trenches up there, water cutoff trenches and other things, it's going to affect your water line and the water line for the hydroelectric plant. Even though that would be a temporary disruption, there's going to be some disruption. I don't know if you're going to be able to park your vehicles, buses over there when all this work is going on, because there'll be a fair amount of work in the area of the mill building. We've had some preliminary discussions with staff at Holden Village about temporarily moving some of the activities from that area over to maybe the Winston Town site on a temporary basis during the construction. And that's going to be a monumental effort, but I think to keep people, particularly kids, from going across the river during the construction and getting, you know, everybody's curious. I'm not sure who's worse, kids or adults, but during the mine entry, we have a lot of curious adults trying to get inside the enclosed area over there to see what was going on. So there's going to be some real safety issues. I don't know if has URS and Tampa had any additional discussions with you about some of these things yet.
How about the noise level?
Ah, boy, I don't know. It's going to, you know, we're not going to do a lot of blasting or anything like that. There's going to be a lot of heavy equipment operating. The Rower Creek kind of, you know, the noise, the creek kind of cuts down or muffles noise coming across, but.
I was here when they covered it with the sand and the dirt in 87, it must have been 89, 90. And there really wasn't that much interruption in terms of noise. Railroad Creek really does do a pretty good job of muffling that sound, so if that's any indication.
When the mining company gave this to the church, if you will, what did they give? I mean, the village, the whole mine, what is Holden own now? What was given to them? What did they have to give the mining company? I guess what I'm getting at is, was part of their motivation giving out this, we're just at the time thinking, we know we got a mess, we're unloading it to church organization, they can do what they want, but we're walking away from it. What was that?
Well, of course, that was way before CERCLA was ever passed.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
They were not, and of course, the environmental laws are essentially very, very, very few environmental laws at that time. I mean, what some of the states had some environmental laws, Washington did. But they tried to sell the Holden mine to a number of different entities, and they all fell through. I don't know why. Some of the reasons were that whoever bought it, because it was largely National Forest System lands here, except for patent money claims, that whoever purchased it would have to meet certain objectives and goals the Forest Service had for the site. And I think most of the entities that were interested in it didn't want that sort of governmental control. And so Hollis Sound simply wasn't able to sell it for, you know, a substantial amount of money, so they essentially donated it to the church for a dollar. Not to the church, but to the
is the whole mine, the whole mountain? It's maybe a dumb question.
Well,
is that the churches or now? Or
no,
who?
There are no. Holden Village, and maybe Christopher or Janet, you could correct me if I get off here, but the village, Holden Village Inc. and Lutheran Bible Institute, they're 50-50, as I understand it. Maybe it's not exactly 50-50, but at least that's what I've been led to believe. And, 50% ownership of all of the buildings here in the village, the buildings across the creek, all the patented mining claims, and I can't remember now how many patented mining claims, but at least 8, that encompasses the ore body and what's left of it, and then 2 mill site claims that are 5 acres each, another 10 acres. Up in the mill building area. I don't know what else you own here. There were originally, when the transfer occurred originally, there were also a large number of unpatented mining claims that went along with it. And all of those have since been abandoned or released, null and void. So there are no more unpatented mining claims. For a long time, Holden Village maintained that mining claims, unpatented mining claims on the tailings piles. That was more to keep other people from coming in and digging them up. But all of the tailings and a fair amount of the waste dump, the 2 big waste dumps are on National Forest System lands. And I don't know, you may own some other things down in Lucerne or
It's all loose.
You own a lot of scrap metal too, up at the third level.
Do we own the building?
Yeah.
And the land under there?
Well, not the land.
Okay.
On where that, where it's patented, you do.
But the rest is still.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why the Forest Service, of course, Cola Village operates these buildings under a special use permit to maintain the buildings here, and that's another reason why you kind of come under tight control of how buildings are used and maintained. Even though your buildings are still are situated in the National Forest, and if it wasn't for the special use permit, the Forest Service could have them removed or ask you to remove them. So that's why there's a certain amount of control and things that come under the permit.
The obviously that you said that there's going to be some changes up there. And the hydro plant is pretty important. Is there, that's no change to that?
Right now, it's not in an area that where it would need to be removed and moved. Matter of fact, if you looked at some of the, and I have detailed drawings with me, it's kind of hard to show them on the screen, but it looks like there's none of the facilities are going to be, what you currently have over there will be moved, like the new shop and things like that. But they're going to be impacted, depending on how much activity occurs.